I'm Chris Hedges, and you can find more of my work at chrishedges.substack.com. The integrity and quality of public education in the United States has been under assault for decades, as Ellen Schrecker documents in her new book, The Lost Promise: American Universities in the 1960s. The American dream of high-quality, affordable, mass higher education is no longer within reach of many Americans. Tuitions, once low, if not free, have soared, and with them tremendous student debt. Although the Biden administration has made an effort to reduce some of this debt, millions of students, graduates, and dropouts still owe a staggering $1.6 trillion. State legislators and the federal government have dramatically slashed funding to public universities, forcing them to seek support from corporations and reduce most faculty to the status of poorly paid adjuncts, often lacking benefits as well as job security. Nearly 75% of the instruction at colleges and universities is in the hands of adjuncts who have no hope of being granted tenure. Public institutions, which serve 80% of the nation's students, are chronically short of funding and basic resources. Higher education has evolved, even at major research universities, into primarily vocational training, no longer a vehicle for learning, instead one about economic mobility. The assault sees elite schools where tuitions can run as high as $80,000 a year, cater to the wealthy and the privileged, locking out the poor and the working class. Joining me to discuss the crisis in higher education is Ellen Schrecker, retired professor of history at Yeshiva University and the author of numerous books, including her latest, The Lost Promise: American Universities in the 1960s. In the book, you argue that the upheavals on campus in the 1960s laid the groundwork for the assault against higher education. But before we go into that, you contrast what was happening in the United States and at the universities with the early periods of the Cold War. You note that there was no blacklist. The expansive job market not only enabled the protagonists in your book to find new academic positions once they were removed, that it removed the fear that had previously constrained colleagues from making a fuss. More professors were willing to stand up for sanctioned colleagues, refusing to countenance violations of academic freedom and professional autonomy. You at one point in the book call this the golden age. We're talking about the 1960s of higher education. But just to begin, what did we come out of? Because people had to sign loyalty oaths in the 1950s. I remember Sheldon Wolin telling me that he signed one. He said he'd signed one in the military. It doesn't make any difference if he signed one to teach at Berkeley. But just set the stage before we go into the 60s.
Sure. What the 60s followed was McCarthyism, which I have written about as well. And during the late 40s and 1950s, there was a massive political chill on American campuses. We all know about Joe McCarthy and Have You No Decency, Sir? And we know as well about J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, who was collecting political information of a, you know, sort of conservative nature, for more than 100,000 people at least. This was a period of repression. There were congressional investigations. There were blacklists. In my own work, I interviewed more than 100 faculty members who lost their jobs for political reasons during the late 40s and 1950s. The irony here is that at the same time that Hoover and McCarthy were running roughshod over the First Amendment, colleges and universities were experiencing their quote-unquote golden age. They were experiencing a moment when the American people were incredibly supportive of higher education. The GI Bill after World War II brought a whole new cohort of students onto American campuses, which were no longer mainly for the elite, but were educating middle class, lower middle class, not too many working class or lower class Americans, and was expanding enormously, as were faculty members who really benefited from this so-called golden age. There was money being thrown at people, myself included, to go to graduate school, to get a PhD, and then, as people today would be salivating about, people could get jobs.
Well-paying tenured jobs.
Well-paying tenured and tenure-track jobs. And as you noted earlier, if they were fired for political reasons, they would find another one. There were so many jobs.
Which wasn't true in the 50s. And I remember from your earlier book on McCarthyism, which I didn't know until I read your book, the FBI would go even into high schools with lists of professors or teachers that they wanted removed without any evidence at all. And these people would be instantly dismissed. And then they were blacklisted. They couldn't get hired anywhere else.
Right. But those, by the mid-50s, Sputnik in 1957, when the Soviet Union sent the first satellite up into orbit, at that point, higher education, especially, of course, in the sciences, was considered a matter of national security. So they were really throwing federal money. States were sort of looking to build up their universities. They wanted to have the prestige as well as the winning football teams. And it was really a genuine golden age for people who were interested in ideas. It was very exciting to be a graduate student in the late 1950s and early 60s.
I want to, just as an aside, talk about the historically black institutions, because you mentioned Philander Smith College in Little Rock, and that because of anti-Semitism, Jewish refugees often ended up at these institutions. This is not in your book. I just happen to know. Also, a lot of blacklisted professors ended up at colleges like Philander Smith in Little Rock. And Philander Smith College is where the great theologian, the radical theologian James Cone, was educated. And I just thought that was fascinating, that because of anti-Semitism and because of McCarthyism and because historically black institutions were considered or marginalized in second tier, you often had these tremendous faculties on them at that particular time. So let's start with the beginning of the unrest on the universities. You spend a lot of time in the book talking about the free speech movement at Berkeley and the importance of teach-ins, which I didn't quite get until I read the book, how important those were. So perhaps you can speak about that.
Okay, but I want to speak, since you're actually discussed those black colleges and universities, sure, the HBCUs, is of course where the 60s began to a large extent, because it's the students at schools like Fisk University in Nashville or Moorhead and Spelman in Atlanta that really began the sort of, or really jump-started the civil rights movement in a way that brought political activism first to their own campuses and then to the rest of the country. And the one of the things I discovered was that most of the leaders of the what we might call the academic left had in one way or another been involved with the civil rights movement before the Vietnam War, before the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. They had been working with the main civil rights organizations fighting for racial equality. So it's incredibly important to know, make that connection between the movements of the later 60s on American campuses, and then, of course, the repression against them, to make that connection between the sort of political awakening after McCarthyism and the civil rights movement. And I can remember I interviewed a sociologist, a very active sociologist named Dick Flax, who told me that when he was in graduate school at the University of Michigan, that when he went out on the street and saw a group of students and faculty members picketing in front of the Woolworth store, which was a national chain that had been boycotted by the civil rights movement, he said, "Oh, finally, there's some political action happening on campuses." And that was incredibly important.
Well, two of the important figures in your book, Staunton Lind, who we just lost, unfortunately, and Howard Zinn, I think they were both at Spelman, both fired because they were doing precisely that with their students.
Exactly. Howard Zinn would take his students. They desegregated the Atlanta Public Library. They just went in and student after student would ask for a copy of John Stuart Mill's On Liberty. And then finally, the Atlanta library officials decided they were more trouble than they were worth, and so they desegregated the place. So Zinn was incredibly important in the civil rights movement and then later on in the anti-war movement, and is a main sort of history maker as well as a historian. Staunton Lind, the same thing, although Lind was not fired by Spelman.
He was fired from, pushed out of Yale eventually.
Yeah. What happened was he quit. He quit as a protest against the firing of Howard Zinn.
Right.
And was immediately hired by Yale. So this is somebody who is not exactly a slouch as a historian. He's quite reputable, wrote a very important book on the American Revolution. What we're seeing there is a connection between the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And lots of people who were active during the 60s did get their start picketing Woolworths, or even more important, like Mario Savio, who was the leader of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, went south the summer of 1964 in a project called Mississippi Summer to help register African-American men and women as voters in Mississippi. They had really been they lost the right to vote. This Mississippi Summer Project was trying to do was gain attention, because there was so much political repression in Mississippi and so much violence. I mean, people were being killed for trying to register to vote. And so the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, devised this program of sending white, well-connected college students to do voter registration in Mississippi to get some attention. And it worked. It certainly worked. And many of those, what shall we say, veterans from the Mississippi Summer, from the civil rights movement in the North as well, became active, very active in the following, decade.
That's also true for William Sloan Coffin, who you write about in the book.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the free speech movement at Berkeley. It occupies a pretty important chunk of your book.
Right. Well, you don't ordinarily have such a dramatic change in the political climate as you do with the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. It launched the student movement. It was the first time in American history where students engaged in nonviolent direct action directed against their own universities on political issues. This politicized American students who until then, maybe they were sort of interested in left things. Maybe they were interested in Cuba. Maybe they were interested in anti-nuclear weapons, in the anti-nuclear peace movement. But Berkeley did it. Berkeley said, you know, your university is behaving in an undemocratic manner. This was what the free speech movement was about. The university would not let student groups on campus recruit students for off-campus political activities. It was incredibly repressive, much more so than you would expect, because Berkeley was a major, major school. And most people sort of thought of it as a rather liberal place by the late 50s, although during the height of the McCarthy period, it had a loyalty oath for faculty members that led to firings and a blacklist. But by the mid-60s, Berkeley was a kind of political scene. People were going there, and they were radicals, and then people who got there who weren't radicals got radicalized. So Berkeley was kind of a hotbed. And then, boom, you know, a group of students, like 1,000 students, sat down around a police car that was taking a civil rights activist to the local jail because he had violated the university's regulations on recruiting students for off-campus political activities. And that did it. The university cracked down on student leaders. Student leaders fought back, organized the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, and forced the university to revise its procedures for on and off campus political activities. In other words, the free speech movement was fighting about free speech. It wasn't a very radical demand. You know, they weren't demanding curricular changes or the hiring of certain radicals or anything like that. All they wanted was to have the same political rights as any other American.
You write in the book, as a result, the authorities paid insufficient attention to the content of student demands while seriously overreacting to their style. This is, of course, a political figure like Ronald Reagan rides this into the governorship and eventually, of course, the presidency. So at the, you're right that it wasn't particularly radical in any way, but it got a lot of coverage. I think there's the picture of Mario Savio standing on top of that police car, right?
Sure.
And that really triggered the kind of rightist forces that had been in sympathy or in many cases actually participated in McCarthyism.
Exactly. There was a beginning with Berkeley, a real backlash against the students. I mean, what they were doing was not necessarily legal. They were trespassing. They had taken over the administration building at Berkeley. This had never happened before, not for any political cause. And so, you know, the administration at Berkeley was blindsided. They hadn't expected this. They didn't know what to do. Nobody was expecting, I mean, one of the themes of the book is simply that this was unprecedented. This was the first time in history that university administrators had to deal with left-wing radicals who were disrupting classes, who were taking over buildings, who were demonstrating, who were doing things that the administration wanted stopped. This was really bad publicity.
I just want to talk about the role of the FBI. They start disseminating all sorts of allegations to to figures within the administration, for instance, the vice chancellor, Alex Sheriffs, who became Reagan's top advisor in education, that this was a communist radical bloc. None of this was true, of course. The elements of the free speech movement were practitioners. These are FBI words, tactics of Fidel Castro and Mao Zedong. And this charge, this demonization of the students was picked up by the media. You write that there was not much sympathy within the public for the students. They did a very effective job at marginalizing them on a national level.
Yeah. This was done from the start with the Berkeley, free speech movement. Clark Kerr, the president of Berkeley, who was one of the first victims, in fact, of the backlash against the student movement. Clark Kerr was being fed stuff, through this guy, Sheriff, who was a vice chancellor at Berkeley. And Sheriff was being fed stuff by the FBI about the so-called communist connections of these crazy students. And Clark Kerr, to his discredit, parroted that stuff and talked about it. The main evidence they had for these communist connections was the fact that one of the leaders of the free speech movement was a undergraduate student named Bettina Apthecker, whose father was a well-known or publicly known communist historian. And so, therefore, they claim that, look at that, the communists are in charge. Well, Bettina Apthecker was not only the only woman or one of the few women in the leadership of the free speech movement, but she was one of the most moderate figures in that group. She was somebody who didn't shout slogans or anything. She said, look, you know, we're just asking to be given our rights and let's work this out. And ultimately, the cavalry that came to the rescue of the students was the faculty. This is very important. There was a important vote by the Berkeley Faculty Senate in about 2 months into the free speech movement, when the campus was just doing nothing but holding meetings. And the faculty held a meeting and voted in favor of revising the school's regulations for political activity on campus, and managed to convince the Board of Regents, which was the final authority to make those changes, and the free speech movement ended with a victory, definitely a victory, with a new, more democratic form of campus regulations.
And this leads into the anti-war movement. And of course, students are directly affected by the war. Much of the anger on campuses is about collaboration between universities and the war industry, including the manufacturing of chemical agents such as Agent Orange, etc. And you said the escalation of the war brought about the creation of a new form of protest, the teach-in, which you place a lot of importance. You consider a very important moment. One of the things I found moving, by the way, is the way the students would react to the teach-ins, that it suddenly gave a vitality to their university experience, almost euphoric in the sense that professors came out of the classrooms. These things were often done outside or outside the confines of the university. They would last, I think at one point you said like 30 hours or something. But talk about that.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I discovered in my research was that at the time the Vietnam War really escalated, which is in the early spring of 1965, which is what? 3 months after the end of the free speech movement. Okay? So, you know, boom, There's the free speech movement. And then all of a sudden there's Vietnam. And what I discovered was that nobody knew anything about Vietnam. It had been a French colony. It had fought for more than a decade against the French after World War II to win its independence. It was led by communists, so that the American foreign policy establishment, especially in the aftermath of McCarthyism, which had a large component of attacks on the Truman administration for, quote unquote, losing China. We have to understand there was a major revolution in China. Communists came to power. So there was a sense that in the Johnson administration, we can't lose another country. We can't lose another country because the Truman administration was under such heavy attack. We don't want to go through that again. Little did they know, of course, that they were doing something that would, in fact, lead to a massive anti-war movement. But anyhow, in the beginning, nobody knew anything about Vietnam. My late husband wrote the first sort of best-selling book. It was a kind of a collection of documents and articles about Vietnam that was published in the summer of 1965. It became a bestseller because nobody knew anything.
Ellen, I want to stop you there because I only have 5 minutes left. And so you saw the rise of the anti-war movement. The same tactics were used to demonize the campus radicals, if we want to call them that, that were used in the free speech movement. And this led to tremendous blowback against the universities. Just briefly tell us what the blowback was and where we are now.
Okay. Well, we're skipping.
I know.
Many things,
well, it's a long book. People are going to have to read it. So.
Oh, good idea. And eventually it's going to come out in paper.
Okay.
So anyhow, what happened was, you know, the Berkeley free speech movement made the career of Ronald Reagan. A lot of other rather opportunistic politicians followed suit. And within a few years, by the early 1970s, there were laws on the books against student radicals. They criminalized anybody who rioted on campus in certain states. They took away their state funding, but especially they took away funding for the institutions across the board. They were still expanding in size, but the percentage of their budgets that was being supplied by the states and federal government as well, decline. And so where did these schools get the money to continue? Student tuitions. That's where this massive debt, $1.6 trillion, was accrued. Universities raised tuitions, and they cut costs. And the cutting of costs led to a hollowing out of the faculty. They did not replace full-time tenure track and tenured professors when they retired. They simply hired adjuncts, part-time workers, or people on one or two-year contracts, none of them with any academic freedom, none of them with the ability to
Great. We're going to stop there. That was Ellen Schrecker on her new book, The Lost Promise, American Universities in the 1960s. I want to thank the Real News Network and its production team, Cameron Granadino, Adam Coley, and Kayla Rivera. You can find me at chrisedges.substack.com.
All right, and previous program was the Chris Hedges Report, and that is heard Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. here on WBAI New York and 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. And while that program is on the air, please consider becoming a financial supporter by calling 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. That's give to